Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm well.
I'm happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, a documentary that set out to humanize terrorists held at Gitmo has found itself the subject of criticism, but not from the people you might expect, or at least not from the people the New York Times seems to have expected. In a lengthy profile of Jihad Rehab and its director Meg Smaker, possibly Smacker, I don't know how to, I've never heard her name before. The New York Times noted that critics warned the documentary, which featured interviews with men in Saudi rehabilitation centers for accused terrorists, among others. We are told that film critics warned that conservatives might bridle at the portrayal, but in a turn of events that should surprise very few by this point, attacks on the film came instead from the left rather than the right. Here's the New York Times, quote, Arab and Muslim filmmakers and their white supporters accused Ms. Smaker of Islamophobia and American propaganda. Some suggested her race was disqualifying, a white woman who presumed to tell the story of Arab men, end quote. Now, the Times allied some of the other controversies here. There was some suggestion that the prisoners being in prison could not consent to the interviews, and doing the interviews put some in grave danger. They said, oh, you know, we didn't know that these interviews that you were doing on tape for a documentary would be put in a documentary and submitted to film festivals. We are naifs in this world of ours. But these all strike me as fairly obvious, you know, kind of trying to insist on more stringent rules for something that has fallen in disfavor for other reasons, right? Yeah, there's a reason that Abigail Disney, an executive producer on the film, said that it, quote, landed like a truckload of hate, end quote, in her open letter begging for forgiveness for supporting such terrible, terrible, inappropriate, problematic work. The real question here is who gets to make movies about whom, right? Again, names, I do not know how to pronounce this. I'm going to flummox this, I'm sure. Asiya Boundawi, a filmmaker, critiqued it for a documentary magazine, The Times notes. Here's what she said, quote, to see my language and the homelands of folks in my community used as backdrops for white savior tendencies is nauseating, she wrote. The talk is all empathy, but the energy is Indiana Jones, end quote. I mean, I wish my movies that I made in never had Indiana Jones energy, but that's neither here nor there. This isn't the only documentary to come under fire because the filmmaker who directed it is of the wrong race. Some have suggested that the great Ken Burns shouldn't be allowed to make a documentary about Muhammad Ali because he's white and therefore cannot possibly understand what Ali went through as a black man in America. I mean, if Ken Burns isn't safe, et cetera, et cetera. None of us have seen the documentary, so we can't really comment on that. But that's kind of the point of this. The whole reason controversies like this exist is to stop art from being made and to stop it from being seen if someone does have the temerity to make it. This is one reason I find the Times' framing of the complaints so funny, this idea that critics were practically giddy for impotent complaints from the right, you know, about how, oh, this is terrible, how dare they humanize these people, and are utterly unprepared for equally specious yet deadly serious complaints from the left. Gatekeepers only have as much power as you give them. And as a result, there isn't a single conservative gatekeeper in this whole industry, really. Alyssa, what do you make of this whole mess? You can't just grumble. That's not podcasting. You have to use your words.
That was not grumbling. That was groaning. Like you said, I have not seen this documentary. And like many of the people who are critiquing this documentary, I have not seen this documentary. So it's entirely possible that it is ham-handed and reductive and offensive, and Sundance shouldn't have programmed it in the first place. I haven't seen it. I don't know. But I find the behavior of people like Abigail Disney particularly gutless in this area. And the idea that this line of critique would be surprising to anybody, it's just bizarre given like the entirety of the post 9/11 media landscape, right? Like does no one remember the response to 24 or the response to Homeland or, you know, like the response to 300 or, you know, just the, you know, the response to Zero Dark 30, right? I mean, we have several decades of debate about, you know, the extent to which, you know, depictions of Muslims in media are dominated by stories about terrorism, questions about who can tell those stories, what's appropriate. And so the idea that anyone would be surprised by this discourse is ridiculous. And someone like Abigail Disney, who should know better going into this, should have been in a position where she was prepping her filmmaker for how to respond to these kinds of questions instead of throwing her under the bus with enormous apparent force. I mean, you know, I think this is clear. I mean, this is clearly a tricky area, right? And in ways that are, I think, legitimate to talk about, right? I mean, you know, the Saudi regime had my colleague Jamal Khashoggi, you know, murdered and dismembered with a bone saw, right? Like, I don't place a lot of credibility in anything they're saying or doing. I think the question of, you know, what these like rehab facilities, the extent to which they're actually successful or useful, is a completely legitimate question to ask. You know, the treatment of the men who agreed to be viewed on camera. Like, I mean, lots of documentarians face ethical issues about like what's going to happen to their subjects. And the Times story made clear that there was a safety review here. But these are legitimate conversations to have about a documentary, about a subject that's this sensitive and that's so geopolitically vexed, right? I mean, that's totally a conversation to have. But, you know, for festival programmers or an executive producer on the film to be surprised by this line of discourse and to, you know, sort of do this to a filmmaker strikes me as real gross. And I'm disgusted by the whole thing. And I think it's bad for, it's bad for a nuanced discussion of the ethical perils of documentary, which are worth having a discussion about. It's just infuriating.
Alyssa, I want to drill down on one point here because, you know, we say like, well, they should have seen this coming. They should have seen this controversy coming. But the kind of flip side of that is if you say, well, you should have seen this coming, then the prudent course of action, some would say, is just to avoid it altogether. Then the thing doesn't get made. Then everybody just kind of goes about their day. And I feel like that's even worse, really.
Yeah. I mean, but just because like, I mean, look, I think all of us like live a certain amount of our lives on the internet, right? We have like I think there are times when I've been legitimately surprised when people have gotten angry about something that I've written. And then I can sort of step back and be like, okay, I see where that reaction is coming from, even if I think it's absolutely ridiculous. You know, maybe a piece that was intended to have a sarcastic tone, you know, didn't convey that clearly enough to readers. Or, you know, maybe I have stepped into a conversation that is very sort of insular to a given community and I didn't know it was out there and boom, now my Menchies are terrible. But, you know, I hope that we've gotten to a place in the media landscape where savvy executive producers and PR people understand that certain kind of kerfuffles are inevitable, but also have a sense of how to navigate them. Or at least that should be the goal, right? I mean, you know, I think that an inability to distinguish between what's loud and what's important is sort of an ongoing challenge of this particular social media culture war age. And, you know, you would think that the entertainment industry would have a long-term interest in discerning the difference and figuring out how to spin or, you know, respond sincerely to what is loud versus what is actually a legitimate critique of things. And, you know, look, if people don't want to be in the business of having anyone mad at them, that's fine, right? Like, you can go, like, sell shoes at a big box store. Like, there are many inoffensive things that you can do for a living. But if you want to be liked, going into any aspect of the media business just seems like a recipe for disappointment.
Peter, you're liked by many people.
Yeah, just not anyone on this podcast.
No, what do you make of this? Because I do think there's an argument to be made here that the New York Times is getting spun on this. That, you know, it's being turned into a culture war fight about, you know, identity politics and blah blah blah. When actually it's about the safety of these individuals.
Okay, so let's take some of these critiques in order. I think the absolute worst critique, which is one of the ones that is being directly lobbed at the filmmaker here, is that she should, the director should not be able to tell this story because she's a white woman and her subjects are not white, right? And that's just a dumb, terrible, incredibly limiting idea about art. I just completely reject that. The best arguments, to the extent that I think these arguments have any merit, is the are questions about the subject's safety. And so one of the sort of core tenets of journalism is source protection. We want to tell stories, and we want to get people's information, we want to get true information out into the world, and we also don't want to endanger our sources. This is a big thing in journalism. And you have to, and if you've ever edited or participated in investigative reporting, something you have to think about a lot. That's obviously especially true when your sources are people who are incarcerated in the regime, you know, in a sort of quasi-prison-like facility in an authoritarian regime. Difficult, complex question. At the same time, according to the New York Times, presuming that the Times is not spinning the readers on this, Sundance officials did ask for a safety plan. They did ask for the consent forms. And quote, here's a quote from the New York Times. The review of her safety methods, quote, concluded that Mrs. Smaker more than met the standards of safety. So when the ethics review was done, there appear to have been no actual issues. No one has raised a specific issue other than this. The circumstances do seem quite delicate, quite dicey at best. And so I think, to me, everything from what I've seen about this, again, if somebody wants to raise a specific issue about the safety, I'll take that as it comes. But to me, if the Sundance officials commissioned an external ethics review and said, or where, you know, looked at an external ethics review and said, look, the ethics review said this is fine, then it seems like that's not a giant issue here. The other issue is whether prisoners have the ability to consent at all. So to that, I would just say that presuming it is true, as we are told in this story, that 150 different men were made available and only four agreed to actually talk, then it sounds like at least some evidence that the folks who participated didn't have to. They weren't being forced to go on camera and sort of read a hostage note saying, oh, you know, here's my story that's been given to me that I just have to read. Because the vast, vast majority of the men who were made available just appear to have said, nope, I am not going to appear on camera. Again, this is what the Times says. I guess if that story is wrong, then I will reconsider here. But I will also just say, in journalism, we do this at Reason a lot. We interview prisoners. We interview people who've been put in jail. And there are always limitations to doing that. It's always something that you have to be careful about doing. At the same time, it's better to be able to talk to those people. It's better to be able to hear what they have to say and print that for readers than to not. How else are you going to be able to access those experiences? And she seems to have done much more than a lot of the other journalists who went to went to this facility and tried to tell this story. One of the asides in the New York Times piece is that journalists from other publications, from big name publications, had gone and had spent a few days or a week talking to the men in this facility. And she spent a year there. She also already had a huge amount of on the ground knowledge, having lived, in the Middle East, learned the language, that sort of thing. Right. That sort of access and that sort of intimacy, that sort of ability to connect with people, is something that we should value in journalism and in documentary filmmaking. And again, I don't think that it's totally unreasonable to raise safety questions about sources in an instance like this. But is this really mostly about the safety questions, or is this really about the fact that some people are mad that a white woman is telling this story? And it seems to me like maybe there's some of both, but a lot of it is happening because people are mad that it's a white woman telling this story. And that's just a completely ridiculous critique.
Yeah, I mean, it just feels like getting Capone on tax fraud sort of thing. Like it feels like you're attacking this from a perspective that is, like, okay, well, this actually, it's about ethics and documentary journalism. But like that really doesn't seem to be the case here. I don't know, though. Again, would be nice to actually see the film. Hopefully it gets wide release. We all get to watch it. Put it on Netflix. Let's check it out. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that gatekeepers are trying to stifle a problematic documentary? Peter?
I think it's a controversy.
Alyssa?
controversy and just really shameful.
Yes, very much a controversy. Don't do things like that, gatekeepers. All right, make sure to tune in for our bonus episode this Friday, in which we are going to discuss the power and the limits of Avatar Mania. Avatar's back, baby, in 4K 3D form. All right, now on to the main event, Don't Worry, Darling, directed by Olivia Wilde, who also has a supporting role. Don't Worry, Darling has found itself at the center of a swirl of controversy these last few months. Affairs, drama on set, stars that refuse to do promo work, Spitgate. But is the movie any good? I'm just going to throw a spoiler warning up now. If you don't want to know what happens in this movie, please turn off the podcast. There's a big twist, if you couldn't have guessed from the trailer. Big twist in this movie, so don't want it ruined for you. Just find that off button. I'm gonna just jabber here for a sec while you reach for it. Oh, you're reaching, you're grabbing your headphones, you're pulling them out. Okay, all right, you're good. All right, so Don't Worry, Darling stars Florence Pugh as Alice Chambers. She's a young housewife living in what appears to be a planned community sometime in the 1950s, where her husband, Jack, who is played by Harry Styles, works as some sort of military contractor, maybe, possibly. Nobody really seems to know what the men in this town do for work. And only the men work. The wives go to ballet class, and they clean the house, and then they shop, and they have nice steak dinners prepared for the men when they get back from the cracker factory or whatever it is they go to during the day. At night, the couples have drunken dinner parties when they aren't ravaging each other senseless. But all is not well in Victory, California. No, things are not quite as they seem. Alice is seeing things. The walls are literally closing in on her. The eggs she plans to cook are empty, crumbling shells. And one of the neighbors kills herself after their boy wanders off into the desert. Jack's boss, Frank, he's played by Chris Pine, feels less like a manufacturer or even an arms dealer than a cult leader. The children in this town are robotic. The wives don't seem to understand what's going on. Everybody has the same origin story. Something is off. Here's the big twist. Turns out that Frank is basically Jordan Peterson, and he's convinced listeners of his podcast to kidnap their wives, imprison them in virtual reality, and force them to treat their husbands like the alphas they truly are. In the real world, Alice isn't a submissive homemaker. She's a doctor! And her sad sack hubby just couldn't handle that. Womp, womp. In other words, look, guys, let's just be clear here. This is a 2-hour-plus Black Mirror episode and not a particularly good one at that. The villain is not really very timely anymore. Jordan Peterson is like 17 outrages ago. And the whole thing, the whole project is just like weirdly, smugly full of itself and into its own like very... I don't know, progressive ideals, but not really progressive. We'll talk about that in a second. Like, imagine if The Matrix decided to set the whole thing in Neo's imprisoned reality and got rid of all the cool wire foo, and then reimagined that to, like, appeal to middle-aged women, and you have some sort of idea of what this movie kind of feels like while you're watching it. The picture has its pleasures, I will admit. Pugh and Pine, both great. Olivia Wilde and cinematographer Matthew Libatique do, it's actually a visually pretty interesting film. And the mid-century modern architecture is to die for, et cetera, et cetera. Look, not terrible. The reveal is just so dumb and unearned that I can't set aside the rest of the good stuff in this movie to appreciate it. Like, Alice doesn't even discover the truth in the town. She just gets pulled out and zapped, and then somebody tells her what's happening. Like, you know, I don't know. It thinking about all the weird plot problems with this movie drive me a little bit crazy. But like the biggest thing is probably like, you know how sometimes on the internet, some people will say like, you know, in Fight Club or The Matrix, where they think that the worst thing that could happen to you is you have a steady office job, right? Like that's kind of how I feel about this movie with its amazing homes and beautiful architecture and wonderful dinner parties and like, you know, healthy sex lives with all that. Like, I don't know, man, if that's prison, it doesn't sound terrible to me.
You would say that as a man.
Well, that's the thing, right, Peter? You like this dumb movie more than I did. What am I getting wrong here?
Well, I agree with your critique in a lot of ways. I mean, this wants to be a big idea movie about troubled men and like toxic ideas of masculinity and, you know, sort of power imbalances between men and women in the workplace. And it's all wrapped up with like, you know, this big twist that the movie is signaling like from the very first minute. You know something's coming. One of the big problems with this movie is that it waits until 3/4 of the way through a 2-hour movie to actually get to the twist. Right. But it like one wants to be, I don't know, Revolutionary Road as retold by Jordan Peele or Betty Friedan translated via the Twilight Zone or something. It's not a big idea movie. It's a dumb idea movie. This idea is dumb. It's just, it doesn't work. It's totally preposterous. It doesn't make any sense when you think about it for not even a second. The movie just leaves you with so many glaring narrative questions that distract you from the ideas that it's kind of trying to like get across, right? Like, just I don't know if it's quite the inciting incident, but one of the big early moments in the movie where Florence Pugh's character kind of realizes something is wrong is when an airplane flies over the town while she's on like a trolley tour bus, and it sort of glitches out or something. Maybe it's not totally clear. She follows the airplane.
It crashes and across the mountains.
Right, and she sees it crash, and she wants to follow it, and she gets to the secret headquarters or something. What was the plane? Like, what was it? Was it a glitch in the simulation? Was it the outside world was making a sound and the simulation had to account for that because maybe there's stuff bleeding in? I guess that's what we're supposed to make of like all the earthquakes or whatever. The movie never even makes a half-hearted attempt to explain any of this. And there's so many questions like this that just come up. Like, again, on an even cursory attempt to think through what this is actually all about. And so the narrative issues are really significant, and the script is pretty bad, and the movie kind of can't get over them. And yet, I kind of enjoyed it all anyway. Because if you take this as not as a like a serious kind of Oscar bait, you know, Jordan Peele, like, let's really, you know, let's deliver the whatever wave feminist ideas, but through the lens of genre in a kind of, in a serious way. If you take it as actually like just a kind of preposterous, pulpy sort of Twilight Zone thing, it really works on its own terms, especially the first 90 minutes. It's like it draws you in. Florence Pugh is really great. Every scene is beautiful. This was a great looking movie. Just at every turn, I really liked the kind of spastic, psychotic editing, the weird visions that she has. Like, there's some daring choices stylistically in this movie that kept me engaged. Like, even the third act, as dumb as it is, when you get to that car chase out through the desert, it really kind of works. And you've got like this big army of guys in red, jumpsuits, which are drawn, I guess, from her, we see the same jumpsuits at the hospital, and it's not clear if like the simulation is drawing things from her experience exclusively or like melding them. Again, big questions, but it's a cool image, those guys all running up the mountainside, and I liked it. I liked like every frame of this movie. I just didn't like any of the frames connected together.
Well, you say it works as a Twilight Zone thing, but that's like specifically how it doesn't work. It doesn't work because it doesn't sell that like, oh, what a twist moment at all. Like it just happens. It's just like, oh yeah, here's. It'd be like the Twilight Zone episode with the kid who runs the town, except you spend the whole time in the town, like you spend like 28 minutes of the episode in the town and weird things are happening, and then at the end you're just like, oh yeah, this kid was doing it.
Wow, spoilers, Sonny. Some people haven't seen the Twilight Zone.
70-year-old episode, whatever. Alyssa, I'm curious to get your take on the like sexual politics of this movie, because they are messed up. As best as, they are like totally, they're not only incoherent, but they're like potentially like deeply messed up.
Yeah, it's so. This movie kind of drives me nuts because I think there's a much more challenging like. Sort of genuinely upsetting and provocative movie hidden behind it. And it's contained in two scenes towards the end after the twist. And neither of them have anything to do with Alice. The first is that Olivia Wilde's character, Bunny, kind of like breaks and warns Alice to get out of town after most of the movie spent like trying to reassure her and calm her down and reintegrate her into the simulation. And she ends up revealing to Alice that she chose to live in the simulation because in the real world, her kids are dead. And in the simulation, she can have a simulacrum of them. Like, she can greet them when they get off the bus. She can threaten to call Santa on them when they're bad. Like, they are, you know, they're eternal scamps. They're never going to age. They're never going to die. And having that for her is better than not having her children at all. And that's a really interesting revelation. It actually echoes Alex Garland's miniseries Devs, which was probably the best thing I saw in 2020. Admittedly, that was a weird year. But that idea of, you know, someone who makes this just like terrible choice, right? Who will live in the simulation and, you know, will give up everything and you know, just live in this ersatz world out of grief and love. But then also you have this weird scene towards the end where Shelley, Frank's wife, who's played by Gemma Chan, who we've seen in Crazy Rich Asians, The Eternals, you know, when she, you know, sort of hears Frank dealing impotently with Alice's impending escape and straight up murders him, tells him, like, you stupid man, it's my turn now. And that scene is never explored at all. But Shelley's a really interesting character in that, like, she's basically like the trad wife avatar in the simulation, right? Like, she leads the ballet classes. She, like, there's this sort of big annual dinner and she treats her husband to a performance by Dita Von Teese, right? Like, she is, you know, she's sort of game for everything. She's very supportive of the project. She gets very angry at Alice when she challenges Frank. And you get this implication that, like, she knows she's living in the simulation and she chose to live there because she likes it and believes in it. And there is a version of this movie where there are a range of people living in Victory, right? Where there are, like, guys who have gotten, you know, seduced by this ideology and are, like, taking care of the body of his personal wife, in air quotes. There are women who have, like, chosen to put themselves under because, you know, the version of the, you know, two couple earner, you know, career woman thing just, like, is not what they want. And there is this movie, there's a potential movie about the seductiveness of the illusion to a wide range of people that is much more provocative about, like, sex and gender than anything the movie actually does, right? Because, and part of what's weird about the movie's unwillingness to pursue that is that aesthetically and sexually, it's very much on the side of the temptation, right? I mean, Sunny, you mentioned, like, the fabulous mid-century, like, furniture and architecture and clothes. Like, it's an aesthetic dream. You know, this, like, Wilde, sort of weirdly before the movie came out, sold Victory as this, like, sexual utopia. And you see, like, multiple scenes where, you know, Alice and Jack are having sex and she reaches a climax either because he's going down on her or because, you know, that's just, like, where the focus is. And you never see him, like, reach fulfillment, right? You know, so, like, the movie is sort of aesthetically and narratively on the side of the illusion and then, you know, stacks and then suddenly stacks the deck against it with the twist. And, you know, I think the way the twist is, I agree with Sunny, the way the twist is revealed is, you know, narratively and visually incoherent. But, like, that scene of Jack coming home and, like, lying down in bed with her and the weird projections on that, the canopy that he has set up, like, that's genuinely, like, eerie and unsettling. But having, you know, so thoroughly stacked the movie in favor of the idea that this, like, simulation is great, it then has to sort of overcompensate to be like, oh, no, this is this is actually monstrous and terrible, instead of grappling with the question of, like, why that might appeal to people, right? And that's, like, that's the much more interesting and from, like, a sort of a question of politics, like, the much more dangerous and interesting question, especially given the political moment that we're in.
Well, it's interesting there. You know, Olivia Wilde obviously did a lot of press before the movie. And here's a tweet from a Variety interview with her, you know, a month or two before the movie came out. Olivia Wilde discusses her approach to focus on female pleasure and sex scenes. And don't worry, darling, quote, men don't come in this film, she declares, only women here. Now, here, like, I'm sorry that they're like laying out this whole, like, look at this girl boss fantasy land, you know, like women's pleasure is the importance, but also saying, like, in the text of the movie itself is that this is a bad thing. Like, the text of the movie is that, like, this is a prison in which they have been placed and, you know, the pleasure is just keeping them there. And, like, I'm sorry, this is, like, that's, like, a weirdly regressive thing. That's, like, a weirdly reactionary thing for a movie like this to be saying.
The movie is very at odds with itself. I totally agree with you about that.
I think Alyssa is right to say that there is an interesting idea at the heart of this and that you could make a very good movie with this concept. And, you know, Alyssa focused on on the idea of resistors. And I would just say that, like, to me, the big problem is that the reveal is so clearly set up from the very beginning. You know that there's going to be something, something weird, something sort of science fiction-y or you know, some kind of fantasy, some sort of fantasia here. Because it's so clear that they don't exist on something that truly resembles the planet Earth, just because they're so separated from it, right? From the rest of society. And to me, this movie should have had her escape, or at least partially, at the quarter point. The bulk of the movie should have been an escape from this, and then she should have had to rescue all, like, felt the need to go and find the other women who are in her little cul-de-sac or whatever, and rescue them, and then, to get to Alyssa's point, found that some of them wanted to be there and may even have been part of the organizing force behind the thing, right? And, like, that's a much more interesting movie. There's action, there's, right, the, like, in the outside world that sort of drives this, right, rather than just sort of the slow brooding dread. There's, like, opportunities to interact with people's different reasons for being there, whether they are trapped in some cases or whether they have trapped themselves in other cases. Like, it also allows you to explore the concept a bunch more and answer all the questions that this movie just didn't want to answer, because it wanted to sort of do the metaphor thing without actually engaging at the genre level that is required.
Yeah, I just like, everything about this movie is weirdly unsatisfying. I don't know. What did you guys make of Harry Styles? Harry Styles, big draw for this movie. People want to come see the singer do the acting. What'd you guys think of? What'd you think of Harry?
Good hair.
Yeah, his casting works a lot better once the twist happens, in a way, because he's sort of blah in the first three quarters of the movie that, like, when you find out this is, like, a sort of weak and monstrous person's, like, projection of himself as an alpha, it retroactively works better. It is very interesting to, like, think about what this movie would be like with Shia LaBeouf in it.
I feel like Harry Styles actually did a much better job than Shia LaBeouf would have done. I just don't think Shia LaBeouf has it in him to play a role like this that is both where he can both seem dashing and sort of pathetic without chewing the scenery too much, because LaBeouf just likes to LaBeouf is too much of a ham, I think, for a role like this. And I liked the way that Harry Styles had, like, I liked the ease with which he played dashing in the first, I don't know, 100 minutes of 85 minutes of this film.
I also would like to see the alternate version of this movie with Shia LaBeouf. I think it'd be much more interesting. All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down? Don't Worry, Darling. Peter?
I kind of enjoyed watching it, and I will probably actually watch this again at midnight at some point in my life. It's not a good enough movie for me to give it a thumbs up. It's a thumbs down.
Alyssa?
I feel like I'm going to give it a thumbs up only because I want other people to see it so I can talk to them about it.
Thumbs down. Bad movie. Do better at making movies, Olivia Wilde. All right, that is it for this week's show. Make sure to swing by atma.thebulwark.com for our bonus episode on Friday. Make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.